Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 31 of Real Talk. Well, we're heading into the final days of summer. Yes, technically summer does go until September, 20th or 21st. But the final days before Labor Day, in my mind, are the final days of summer. School has started for most kids, my kids, not until right after Labor Day. But the fourth quarter push to me starts right after Labor Day. Yes, I understand the fourth quarter does officially start on October 1st. But if you're going to close a deal in the fourth quarter, and if you don't have it under contract by, let's say, mid-October, and you need debt, good luck on trying to finance and close before year end. So a mid-October effective date on a PSA means you need to have an LOI signed, likely end of September, first week of October, which means if you're not talking to sellers, buyers, and getting an LOI together in the first couple weeks of September, it's going to be hard to close the deal prior to year end. Now, there are always last minute scrambles and urgent deals, which happens in every year. And I'm expecting an uptick of those types of transactions, especially this year, as sellers decide late in the game, they want to book a transaction before year end, or capital that needs to be allocated in 2023 decides late in the year to chase those distressed deals. So we'll see what happens. And I think we'll get an indication on how busy our fourth quarter is in the first 10 to 20 days of September. Now, this week on Real Talk, we go international. I have Richard Benson, the managing director of Ardent Companies, on our show. Richard runs the UK office. I met him when I was in London earlier this summer, and I interviewed him recently to talk about what Ardent is doing in London, throughout the UK, both on the debt side and the equity side. We talk about, you know, the different aspects and the way they look at office compared to how maybe we're looking at office in the US. And of course, I can't be talking to a Brit without talking about Ted Lasso, one of the greatest shows on television. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Richard.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I have Richard Benson on, managing director of the Ardent Companies. Richard, how are you?
I'm really well, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me on this.
Well, as I think my audience can now gather, your accent is a little different than mine and most of our audience. And so why don't you tell our audience where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. So I'm over here in London, over in the UK, where I kind of co-lead the London office for the Ardent Companies.
Well, you're making history because you're not our first non-US guest, but you are our first non-US guest who's doing the podcast not in the United States. So we are definitely going global on Real Talk.
Well, I'm absolutely honored to be breaking that glass ceiling with you, Andrew. It's an absolute pleasure.
So tell our audience, what's the Ardent Companies?
So the Ardent Companies is a traditional private equity real estate company. We're actually headquartered in Atlanta. We just celebrated our 11th year, our head office is in Atlanta. We also have an office in New York, one in Charlotte, and the first overseas operation, of course, was London, which opened in January 2021. We kind of started originally back all those 11 years ago, really in the distressed and opportunistic space. We kind of coming out to the back of the GFC, the partners at the time saw the opportunity from kind of what they'd been doing previously and then came together to do it, to look to take on non-performing portfolios and distressed opportunities. And really from that moment, they grew that out. And then there came a point in the evolution where they thought, well, you know what, we don't need to just buy other people's debt, we can actually originate our own. And then we started a lending platform from there, which was incredibly successful. And that in turn, as again, the economy continued to progress and improve, They came to the view that, well, you know what, we don't need to just take the debt position in a lot of these detailed deals. Maybe we can be the equity in them as well. And that's ultimately how we've become to be a kind of really quite rounded private equity investment house. As at today, we're about $2.5 billion of assets under management across both equity and debt. Most of that obviously is in the US. We've only been going in the UK for 2.5 years, which is still relatively young by the history of any company, and certainly by the history of my country. But since we launched over in the UK, we've managed to acquire 20 industrial estates. That's 2.25 million square foot of industrial estates around the country. We've also bought a couple of retail assets. One is a shopping centre in a town called Solihull, which sits just outside the UK second city of Birmingham. It's a very affluent suburb of Birmingham. We had a lot of faith in that when we bought that, and that's been borne out. I can kind of go into a little detail perhaps later about why we do still believe in retail. We're slightly contrarian in that respect. And then our second retail deal was a very unique building in the City of London called the Royal Exchange, originally built during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. So we're talking the 1500s here. By a guy called Sir Thomas Gresham. It was originally supposed to be the British equivalent of the Amsterdam trading floor. It was supposed to be the first UK stock exchange, which it was over time. Stock exchange in the 1500s looked a little different to what they do today. Over time, it's kind of burnt down, be rebuilt. It was kind of most kind of significantly rebuilt during the time of Queen Victoria. And then kind of in the early 2000s, it ceased being a trading floor, an office, like an entirely office location. There are still some offices there. We don't actually own that part. But in the kind of ground and basement parts, there's a very high end retail, an F&B location that we bought towards the end of last year. It's a very unique asset, but one, again, that we have a lot of faith in. We know the back to the office story in London is really quite different, I think, to America. And again, we can probably get into that. That might be of interest. And really, our belief is, firstly, in the strength of the City of London as a location that people will return to and have returned to. And secondly, our belief that the right sort of retail, the right sort of leisure will be successful in the right location. And that's really been the UK approach since we've launched Ardent here.
Hmm. So how does someone living in London get connected with a US company based in Atlanta?
So it's kind of a long story. So I'm actually, I think, as you know, Andrew, a lawyer originally. I'm a qualified lawyer.
I'm sorry for that, but you were smart out like so many of my clients and former colleagues.
Well, you know what? It's a very, very solid grounding. And the last job I had before I was at Ardent was at a major regeneration project called Battersea Power Station. For any of your viewers and listeners who don't know what that is, if you've ever seen the movie The King's Speech, that pretty famous movie, there's a scene in there where there's some guys in white coats powering up some electricity grids. That was actually filmed generally within Battersea Power Station. That's because Battersea Power Station used to power almost all of central London up until the early 1980s when it got shut down. And then it sat there as a bit of a white elephant for an incredibly long time. And I could do a whole podcast just on Battersea Power Station. I won't. But suffice to say, fast forward a number of years, I joined Battersea Power Station. And I was quite happy there as one of the in-house lawyers on the team. And Matt was introduced to me by my brother-in-law, who actually lives in Atlanta himself. Matt was coming over with some of the team and asked if he could.
And just to be clear, Matt Shulman is the founder of Ardent Companies. Yep.
Yeah, Matt Shulman, CEO and founder of the Ardent Companies. And so it was Matt who I met first from the business, together with some of the team as they were in London trying to do some business here. Showed them around. He took me out for dinner, had a chat, and said, "Listen, I've always wanted to get going in the UK. Wanted to go in London." And I said, "That's an excellent decision, Matt. Please do let me know how I can help you." Fast forward maybe about 18 months later, I get a phone call from him saying, "Listen, we're looking at a deal. It's been brought to us by a partner. We really don't know anyone else on the ground other than you. And there's a few things that the partner's saying we're not sure about. Do you mind just kind of having a look at it for us?" And I said, "Of course, happy to." I had no skin in. Had no dog in that particular fight, and you know, as a quite literally friend of the family, I wanted to make sure that was being looked after and that Ardent were being looked after. So, together with another colleague at Bassey, we kind of had a little bit of a look at what he was doing, kind of surmised to him that actually, frankly, it wasn't a particularly great property that was being put to him. The deal itself wasn't fantastic, and the proposed partner was not perhaps being as truthful with them as perhaps they could be. And there was a fairly difficult conversation that I had to have, which was fundamentally, this is not the way to get started over here. Really, Matt, what you need is an ardent office, badged and branded, that you know will live and die with you, that will succeed when you do and lose when you do. And he immediately turned around and asked if I'd be interested in doing that. Now, as a lawyer, perhaps yourself, Andrew, can sympathise, and maybe there are others that sit there wondering, how on earth do I get to stop having to do timesheets and justify my existence in units of 6 minutes, as we do in the UK legal practice? and here it was. And so it took me about 3 or 4 seconds to confirm to Matt that yes, I would indeed be very happy to help him get going with that. COVID a little bit got in the way of getting started, but actually, on the flip side, probably gave us the best buying opportunity that we had, certainly when it came to that asset in Solihull, where we literally bought a shopping centre in the middle of COVID.
Sorry to interject. I'm curious, what was the thesis that Matt had, or that Ardent had, as to why Ardent wanted to go into the UK?
So, Matt and others, and I would agree with this, take the view that what happens in the US tends to happen in the UK about 18 months later. We do seem to track, in some respects, the cycles that you guys experience a little bit after you do. And kind of what's been trending just before we launched the office in the UK was that actually there was this repositioning and repurposing opportunity that's coming through in America. And actually, we'd successfully gone through a few deals already in Atlanta, whereby we take an old retail site, repurposed it, maybe knocked down, maybe reworked the tenants, moved the tenants around, knocked a bit down, repurposed it as multifamily or something else. And those have been really good deals for us in Atlanta. And the view was that on the same thesis that those opportunities should come forward in the UK as well, especially, you know, retail had already been in a difficult position prior to COVID in the UK. And then COVID came along and really did deal a number of schemes a bit of a killer blow. We saw the rise, obviously very quick rise of online shopping, which is why the industrial space is one of the reasons, really, I should say, that the industrial space has became so hot in the UK in those years post-COVID, and one of the reasons that retail became so unloved as well. So the thesis really was that using our skills, knowledge and experience of what we've done in the repurposing space in the US, together with on the ground team who have experience with regeneration and repurposing, which is ultimately what Battersea Power Station fundamentally is, albeit on a far, much, much bigger scale, and kind of taking a dilapidated monument rather than taking an existing and operational asset into something else, that we could also find those opportunities. And it's looked slightly different in the UK. It's not been quite as binary or kind of had the same perhaps opportunities as it was in the US, because, you know, the US is so over retail. You know, one of the stats, there is 23 square foot of retail per person in the US. It's the most over retailed country in the world. Unsurprisingly, in the UK by comparison, we're still number three, but we've got 4 square foot of retail per person. So over retail, but not to the same extent as the US. But nonetheless, you know, there were winners and there were losers in the retail space. And it really was our job when we got started to identify what one of those winners could be. And as it happens, one of the schemes that when we drew up our wish list of which schemes would we go for, where do we believe those opportunities will arise, one of the top three centres on our wish list came up and gave us the opportunity to go after that very shortly after we launched the UK office.
And how big is the UK office now?
So we're now at 6. Person number 6 will be starting kind of about a month from now. So we grew originally from Andrew and I with our respective skill sets. We brought in an investment director who had he was a bit of a minister without portfolio when he first started. He really was getting involved in everything and anything. And as we've evolved, he's kind of gone more down the pure investment route and helping on deal origination, investor relations. We brought in a finance director who is so good that she's now been promoted to global head of accounts and has now got her US visa, where she will be moving to in the coming weeks. So we had to find her replacement. We also brought in another development director to kind of help us with a lot of that repurposing and regeneration work that we were looking to do. And also one of our big belief spaces is in the lending space. So as I mentioned, when I was first talking about Ardent, we kind of very early on in our evolution became lenders. And that's a platform that's been incredibly successful in the States. And we think, bearing in mind the current the current position in the economy, current cycle, that actually lending in the UK makes total sense as well. And we're already seeing early on, whilst we look at the space and having looked at the space for the past 6 months, whilst we gear up for that expansion of our lending platform into the UK, that there is indeed deal flow and opportunity. We're bringing in a UK head of debt who's going to really spearhead that expansion of our debt platform into the UK.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into the broader UK market, but before that, I guess one last question on Ardent specifically. So for several years, I assume mostly US-based investors would invest in Ardent, in US Ardent assets. Yeah. Now that the UK has been open for the last couple of years, is it the same investor base that's investing in both US and UK, or do you have specific investors that only are investing in the UK, and Matt and his team have specific investors that invest just in the US, or is there a crossover?
No, it's definitely a crossover, Andrew. So we've been incredibly lucky with the support that we've received from not just our colleagues in Ardent, but also our investor base. I think it's fair to say that not all Ardent investors have necessarily followed to the UK and taken up the opportunities to kind of come into our specific investments here. So we did use one of our funds, the Ardent Strategic Fund, which was being raised as the UK office was being open. We used that for the first couple of deals. So I guess there are a number of Ardent investors who are in the UK as a result of participating in that fund. But when it's come to kind of raising the kind of some of the co-invest that we have done for some of the deals that we've done here, we're seeing the same people come into those typically. And there's definitely a fair number of Ardent traditional investors who have joined the journey into the UK. And we're incredibly grateful for that support. They've really been fantastic partners. I think we will continue to have that support as we go. But, you know, part of the brief of having a London office is to look to expand our investment relationship. You know, London is as one of, if not, and I can make a very convincing argument, I think the financial capital of the world. And I think there are plenty of opportunities here to grow those Ardent relationships through the London office. And that is absolutely one of the things that we're expected to do as part of the team.
Yeah. So let's talk about you said that what happens in the US will often happen in the UK 18 months later. Yeah. When I was in the UK visiting you or meeting you and I had other meetings, that phrase was used quite often. I thought it was interesting. Some people said 6 months, some people said 12, some you're saying 18. So right here in the US, for the last, I'd call it close to 12 months, we've just been in a state of paralysis. Interest rates have gone up significantly. The Fed has recently raised, 10 out of 11 meetings they've raised. Yeah. Coming out of COVID in 21 and 22 up until the summer, it was the busiest time of my legal career, the busiest time of all my clients' careers. Capital was flowing and cap rates were compressing, but there was an endless supply of money chasing deals across all asset classes.
Yeah.
For the last 12 months, I would say, institutional private equity, global private equity funds that do business both in the US and UK and elsewhere, I call them window shoppers. They say they're open for business, but they're really not. They're walking the streets, looking at the windows and kicking the tires, but nothing of real significance. So any deals that we have been doing have been capitalized through private capital or because of what we have in the US 1031 exchanges where for tax efficiency purposes. We're heading into the close to the fourth quarter, the second half of the year. There's a debate as to whether, when are we going to see the real distress? I mean, people haven't really transacted. Interest rates are up. Capital's on the sidelines looking for distressed opportunities. The fear if they transact today, that same asset will be worth 10 to 15% less in a few months. So why transact now? And the debt is just the cost of debt keeps rising. And yeah. Sellers still see what their assets or remember what their assets were worth just a year ago. Why am I selling at this point? Yet at the same time, there's maturities, loan maturities coming due in the next 6-12 months, the fear that they won't be able to refinance. So all of this is happening in the US market. So yep. That's a long-winded way of saying, what's going on in the UK? How does it compare to what we're seeing in the US?
Yeah, so it's funny. I think my 18-month theory can kind of be thrown out the window and say almost simultaneous, I think, in terms of the description you give, Andrew, is not a million miles away from what we're seeing here in the UK. But the reality is that UK base rate was also going up at the same time and not far off the same pace as US Fed base rate as well, having the same impact here as well. So yeah, cost of debt. We are the Bank of England is due to meet, I think, again this week. We have had slightly more positive inflation news, which may put a halt on further rises, but to be seen. It's not always been clear that the Bank of England necessarily are prepared to put the brakes on the interest rate rises just yet. So we need to see what happens. But you know, transaction volume is down. You know, I still talk to a number of colleagues in the legal world, and they are saying they are significantly quieter today than they were 12 months ago. But I think what we're starting to see in certain areas, I think asset class by asset class, we start to see slightly different views, perhaps, than the US. I know, for example, so offices, I would say, is kind of a big differentiator between the US and the UK right now. It feels that any office anywhere in the US, bar maybe a couple of proper micro locations, really is in trouble. You know, I saw a stat recently, it's 1 billion square foot of vacant space across the US. Apparently, if you stacked it on top of each other, it would go past the International Space Station. So that is necessarily worrying for anyone in the office space in the US. I don't know how accurate that is. Whereas in the UK, your absolute core sector, so I'm talking West End, London West End core, so your Mayfair, St. James's, City core, your glass office towers, there is still life in those places. People are back in the offices. You know, I think I heard it neatly described at a kind of a round table session not so long ago that, you know, we have learned in the UK that it's not that people don't like going to work, it's that they don't like the journey to get there. So commuting is our challenge, not the desire to be there, especially when you have nice offices. So we're seeing a bifurcation of the office market in the UK, where it's the highest quality, highest energy performing, highest environmental standards, and then everything else. And even then, it's down to the micro location. So I think there are still winners in the office space in the UK. You need to be really, really clear-eyed on your micro location, literally as in within, you know, one or two streets. You know, the property A on this corner will underperform property B on this corner, which is only 200 meters away, because of all these factors. It can be as small as that. Industrial is a sector that we think is still quite interesting in the UK. I don't think we're going to see the same level of value in that space that we were seeing maybe 2 years ago, but we are still seeing transactions at pricing that is below the cost of debt, which I think is always quite interesting. You know, lots of people, I think, are still looking for the reversion. So that has helped the multi-let space as opposed to the single let. People are chasing reversion. You might be in it an initial original 6.5 cap going in, but after 18 months, you can expect that to go to 7.5 or 8. So people take the view that that's worth going after as well. We still believe in retail over here. Again, it's stock selection. And actually, the cost of debt is helping us with our pricing on that as well. To make sure you go after the right ones. But you know, really, we're not expanding our debt platform by accident. You know, we are doing so in an environment that we think is conducive to achieving best returns. And any number of private equity houses here are turning their hands from equity investment to debt. I think the difference with us is we've done it for 11 years in the States. We're bringing the talent here to do it and do it well. And I think that'll set us apart as well. One of the other things that's actually big headlines in the UK is the living space, the living sector. We've recently seen promises by our government to achieve 1 million new homes in the UK during this government. So they have got a little over a year to hit that number for the total amount of houses built during this current parliament. And there's going to be a lot of drive towards that. We know we're chronically undersupplied on housing in this country. So, Andrew, there are opportunities in certain spaces, but it's not straightforward. Transaction volumes are down. It is about who can go all cash. Reliance on debt doesn't work for a lot of the sectors. And similarly to what you're saying, we're not seeing the true distress yet, or if it is happening, it's happening very, very quietly, and certainly not being splashed around in the open market. There's a huge number of, for example, of Korean investors who came in very, very hard in 2018, 2019 into the office space in London, bought big, expensive, shiny office buildings off incredibly low debt value and incredibly low debt cost and very low cap rates as well. And the two have gone in the wrong direction for them. So we do expect there to be some sort of trouble coming in that space, whether that's going to be resolved by equity injection, prefect positions, rescue equity, MES, TBC, but we are expecting something in that space to start coming forward. There's something like a £17 billion capital shortfall in the UK market between how much debt is out there and what the value now is of that against what that debt was originally placed against.
Yeah. One of the interesting, paradoxes or distinguishing aspects of what's going on today versus the GFC of 2008 is that lenders, I felt, and I was a lawyer at a large global firm in 2008, lenders seem to take a more aggressive position in 2008, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. There were a lot more foreclosures. There was selling of notes if maybe they didn't want the paper. There was just more transactions. Today, it just seems like the lenders are not quick to either sell paper, foreclose, and they're just waiting. Not sure why the distinction, but it is definitely noticeable.
Yeah, completely agree with that. So over in the UK, post GFC, there were some various banking regulations that were put in place to require banks to be more highly capitalized as against the value of their book, which the idea being that it puts them under significantly less pressure to have to exit difficult lending positions. I think that plays to that point. And I just think you're right. I think just generally this feels different to the GFC. The GFC very much was a true liquidity crisis. Money left the system and could not be found. It's not that the money's not in the system this time round. It's just that it's a lot more expensive and a lot more selective. And that I really think is a major, major difference. And I think banks and owners who can come to an agreement to work things forward, even if it's extend and pretend for a while, will rather do that than put things in the market and thereby create a collapse because you flood the market with cheap real estate.
Yeah. What one asset class that my clients have been fairly active in the UK is in the entertainment space, sound stages, production facilities. Here, I'm not sure how familiar you are, or maybe you are, there's two major strikes in the entertainment industry. Yep. With the actors strike and the writers strike, how long it's going to go, nobody knows. People are saying through the end of the year, but it's definitely causing complexities and challenges in that asset class here. I know over the last several years, clients have looked to international sites, specifically in the UK, to build out these sites. How involved are you in this particular, I'll call it, sub-asset class of industrial commercial?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating space. And you're absolutely right. The demand for soundstage space in the UK is massive. I have friends in the kind of production space and kind of more on the advertising side than kind of TV and movies. But he was telling me that you basically can't get hold of soundstage space in London because it's just all booked up by Netflix, Apple TV, Amazon doing their own stuff, Disney as well. So it's a fascinating space. We've very successfully been in the space in the States. It's not something we've looked at here so far. We're obviously in our industrial portfolio that we actually have one or two properties where it would work incredibly well in terms of the size and the we believe the location. We just need to kind of find the right people to work with us on it. But you know, we're aware, for example, up in Scotland, there's a massive requirement by the and a massive push by the Scottish government. You know, this is very often these are government-led initiatives as well over here. To boost employment, etc. So we know, for example, there's a massive push up in Scotland to deliver more soundstage, more filming space. There's a huge development down in, I think it's Braintree in Essex as well, where they're looking to bring forward a similar, very, very large production development. So it's a huge space. It's one that we know. It's one we're keeping an eye on. We're certainly tracking, but. One of the conversations we have in always internally is if we're going to enter a new space, and we do for this slightly new space, we need to have three things: talent, capital, and pipeline. We certainly have the pipeline for sound stages because you know, we're in the industrial space. We probably have the capital for it, but it's not somewhere that we necessarily have the talent right now. So that's a prime example of what Arden does best, where we look to partner with an operator or a JV partner to help us work to make sure that we're making the best decisions in the best locations and delivering the best product. So certainly a space that we're very open to doing, just not one where we found the right partner to work with just yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. If the strikes continue for a long period of time, there's talk about, and I'm not an expert in this you know, on the strikes and what whether the unions will not allow production beyond the. You know, the U.S. borders, but from my understanding, you know, it does not apply to non-U.S. production. And so the Netflixes of the world, the Amazons, the Apples, as they are expanding globally, that they can continue with non-U.S. actors, writers who are not part of the U.S., you know, unions, and to continue production, and how that would impact these U.S. the two major U.S. unions, the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, maybe I should brush up on my American accent and go start auditioning. But it's listen, it's a you know, I'm a huge movie fan. It's really sad to see that it's kind of come to this kind of situation over there. You would have thought there's a, you know, in theory a way through it, but. You know, it will create more opportunities in other locations as a result of it. It will be a necessary byproduct. You know, every industry, when it has to find a way around things, it will. You know, and the UK is already a very popular place for filming locations, and it will simply, I think, drive more business to our shores.
Yeah. All right. So last on our remaining minutes, I'd like to end with sort of a lightning round set of questions and answers. So quick answers to the following questions. So first, how about the most, I don't know, interesting or unique aspect or challenge of working with an American-based company?
English to English translations.
So do we need subtitles for this podcast?
Well, I hope not. I mean, you tell me, it's for your audience. But for example, when we're talking footfall, you guys are talking foot traffic. When we're talking service charge, you guys are talking CAM. Like, I've learned them now, but it took me a good year or so to understand the language I needed to use. And it probably took the same amount of time for my American colleagues to understand what on earth I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So there's the actual terminology. And then there's just the kind of differences of the way we do things here. So you guys go under offer and escrow, and you're kind of locked in a different way to the way we're locked in. And I kind of have to explain that we're kind of all at risk until pen is on paper. And it's just kind of understanding the two different ways. I probably need to understand a little bit less about how transactions work in the States, but my American colleagues definitely need to understand about how things work over here. As you know, they're the ones sitting on the IC having to understand what I'm talking about.
Hey, you guys need like a laminated glossary like next to your computer. You know?
We've been working on it for 2.5 years. The other Andrew, my other managing director, he has got a note in the back of his notebook of every single term that we've come through that we have to make sure we translate.
Yeah. All right. This is going to be so American of me to even ask this question. Ted Lasso, are Brits fans of the show or not fans of the show?
No, it has gone down really well over here. Actually, I think it is very much enjoyed for what it is. It's a good bit of entertainment.
I love it. How about your favorite football team? I'm not going to say soccer, football team. I noticed a soccer ball, football, behind you.
Yeah, so Leicester City is my team. I'm actually from the city of Leicester, 100 miles north of London. We miraculously won the league. It was arguably one of the biggest sporting achievements ever. If you think about the huge amounts of money that flow into the English Premier League, and little old Leicester with a squad worth a total of something like £25 million actually won the league. We were 5,000-1 shots to do it. Sadly, as we fast forward a few years, we actually got relegated out of the Premier League. I know that's a concept that doesn't exist in any of your sports, but we've dropped down a division because things didn't quite go quite so well. But we had the most amazing 5 or 6 years whilst we won the league and won other cups. So very, very, very special times.
Well, maybe there'll be a show like Wrexham. You'll make this recovery like they have.
That is, I got to tell you, that is the most amazing documentary. I think it's the most amazing story. I mean, it is kind of, it's not the same as Leicester because they're coming from even further down than we were. And it really is quite amazing story. And it's really about, it's a community story, the Wrexham story. It's absolutely, it really is, it's fabulous. It's not a million miles away from Leicester. Leicester really is a community club as well. You have these one club cities like Leicester where everyone gets around it, and like Wrexham where everyone gets around the one team, and you know when they're doing well, it takes the whole city with them. So no, the Wrexham story is very, very special. I do hope they continue up the leagues. It would be great to see a Leicester Wrexham match in the league at some point.
You know, in the US, there's so many different cities and secondary markets and tertiary markets that a lot of my clients choose to invest in to get higher yield. You know, those in the US that may not be as knowledgeable about the UK, what are some of the markets that are under the radar that we may not have heard of that you think over the next few years are up and coming, you know, real estate plays?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're basically saying is, apart from London, what are the other cities? Yeah. So, okay, so in terms of cities that we would look at for certain sectors, so anywhere around that Midlands belt, so Birmingham, Leicester, for industrial, we think it's very interesting. We did a really good investment in Birmingham that's working really well because it just sits in the middle of the country, really, really well located. Glasgow up in Scotland, one of the biggest cities in the UK, very, very strong on student housing, very big student community up there, so lots of opportunity up there. Similarly, down in Bristol, that's another strong university city where people, but then people also stay there. There's a number of kind of major businesses in the West Country that encourage graduates to stay there. So that's not just student, that's buy to rent, as we call it, multifamily as you do, and co-living, which is an emerging asset class over here as well. Manchester, I would say, although not our second city by size, that's Birmingham, I would say Manchester is our second commercial city in the UK. So very well located offices could still do very well, and all the kind of supporting amenities around that as well.
And what type of, like, when a US-based company is talking to a global investor or a non-US investor about their thesis of investing in these smaller markets, such as a Salt Lake City or a San Antonio or an Orlando, where they may not be and they have to educate the global investor about why it's more enticing than investing in a Los Angeles, New York, Chicago. What type of questions are you getting from U.S. investors that are more common that you have to answer about these other markets?
So I think the Solihull deal that we did is a really good example of that process. You know, no one in America has heard of Solihull, and there's a number of people in the UK that probably haven't heard of it either. So why this place? What's so special about it? What's the rationale? And this time, why in COVID and why retail? And it really was just a question of explaining kind of all the data points that we were using and just kind of setting it out really, really clearly about why we had such high conviction on the location and the opportunity. It's completely understandable as a non-UK investor to kind of turn around and say, I don't understand why you would be buying a retail center in Solihull, why not an office in the West End? And the answer is because we can buy, you know, this shopping center in Solihull off a 10 cap, and you're never going to do better than a 3 cap in London. And the upside for Solihull versus London is going to be so, so much more and so much opportunity. And here's a whole stack of data which explains why it's actually a really, really strong proposition. So it, you know, for us, we try and use data as much as we possibly can to explain our thesis, explain why we have high conviction in matters. You know, can strip out all emotion from it. There's limited space in investment and business generally, I think, for emotion, and really kind of boil it down to the data and the clear explanation as to why we think it's a good thing to be doing and why we want to take you guys with us on it.
Yeah. All right. Last question. When we met, we were at this amazing place, Maisonic Estelle.
Yeah.
Five story. What do you call it? An eating club, supper club, drink? What do you call it generically?
It's a members club.
A members club. So like like here would be like a downtown club we have in LA called the Jonathan Club, or Soho House has expanded obviously in the United States, but nothing to the level of this establishment that I met you in, where it was five levels and different restaurants and lounges and bars and studies and libraries, places to watch a sporting event, places for business, places for drinking at 5 o'clock, places for different types of drinking at 11 o'clock, places for dancing, all within one building. Very eclectic, very diverse people, international, all over, an amazing experience. Do you think that could ever be replicated in the United States?
Undoubtedly. Yeah, I think the reason Maison Estelle in particular, I think, works is they've done just the most amazing job of styling it and having a very clear offer. I mean, exactly, say you've got the different restaurants and the different places for the different times. And so if I'm there at 2 o'clock on a grey afternoon for a meeting, then there's one room I'll go to. If I'm there a little later in the afternoon, it's maybe better weather, there's another space I'll go to. And if we're taking some clients out, then there's another space I'll go to. And it works that it fulfills what I need from it in many different ways, in lots of different times. And it's particularly well, it's in Mayfair. It's the heart of what I would say of international London as well. So a lot of the people in that building maybe use it as their office as well. They may not hold another office anywhere at all. They may have their apartment around the corner and that's their space where they go to work, so they have a separation. It may just be pure social. It could be like me. I do have a formal office around the corner, but it makes for a nicer place to go and meet more people. I absolutely think it could work. I think New York for me would be the obvious example of where it would work. But you know, look at Soho House that has gone into so many different locations. I think Maison Estelle, I don't know the ownership, but I can guess what they're trying to achieve by what they've done in London. I think they would probably only ever maybe open one in New York, if they were that way minded. I think they'd be very selective about the cities they were going to go to, and I think they'd be very selective about how they were going to do it. But I completely agree, Andrew. It's a really fun place to go. It was an absolute pleasure to be able to meet you there as well. And it's it's one of the major benefits of living in a city like London, where you just have these really cool, really interesting places where you can spend some time.
Yes. Well, next time I'm there, we'll definitely have a pint or two, watching Wimbledon and hanging out, maybe a football game. Really a pleasure having you on. I know it's later where you are. I look forward to many more conversations, and much success to you and Arden Companies, and specifically the UK division.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Listen, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you, and I look forward to a few points in Maison Estelle when you're next here.
Absolutely. And we'll get the subtitles for those that can't understand.
No problem.
Thanks, Richard.
Cheers, Andrew. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.